Hello everyone, this is Karen McCoy of McCoy Fitness and Health, and welcome to today's interview with Coach Scott Abel. So, for those of you who have been in the fitness game for a while, no doubt you know this man. Scott is now well into his fourth decade as an expert in the physique transformation game. He's coached over 400 bodybuilding champs, figure competitors, models, and taken clients from beginner level to national titles and beyond. He also coaches regular men and women like us looking to sustainably lose fat and look and feel better. Unlike many coaches, Scott's background was originally in sociology, which I love, so he pays keen attention to psychology, the effects and pressures of the media on body image and more. We're going to get into that. He's also well known for his cycle diet, which includes anything goes cheat days and overfeed days, and I know you guys want to hear about that. And Scott's been successfully using this himself and with clients for over 30 years now. So he's written over a dozen books on fitness, nutrition, training, and mindset you can find on Amazon or on his website. If you don't know what it is, scottabelfitness.com. I'll have a link on my site to that as well. And you can also find info on his coaching, ebooks, training programs, audios, videos, and so much more. He's also got a couple free downloads for you. So welcome, Scott. This is such a pleasure for me. Thank you.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thanks for having me.
So I don't know, I did mention this to Scott. I think some of you guys know. I actually contacted Scott. It would have been, I know he doesn't remember, but it was about 25 years ago. And it was when I was looking to, I had done the Alberta Provincials, and I was looking to go on. And I think we chatted briefly. Tell me you remember that, Scott.
I'd be lying.
Okay, so anyways, I've been following Scott's work for decades. Yes, it makes us sound old. I guess we are in the older echelons. And I think what sets you apart from a lot of the coaching crowd is a few things for me. First of all, I love your candid approach. No BS. You really tell it like it is. You have a real huge focus on research. You're always up to date on that, which I find very interesting as well. But not only that, what you mentioned with your background in sociology, you're a watcher of people. Like, you really, really channel in. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you bring that into the blend with fitness and your clients?
Yeah, it's something that, unbeknownst to me growing up, I was just very naturally attuned into. I think it had to do with a lot of child-rearing things and those kind of things, but it became very natural for me to be able to assess people pretty accurately in terms of their own psychology and whatnot, even before I had labels for it. And then I got into social work and things like that. And when I was doing my master's degree, actually one of the letters of recommendation said that Scott does naturally what we study our whole careers to be able to do. So it was kind of like a nice compliment. And you know, since then, it's allowed that kind of ability to communicate well with people, has allowed me to be a leader in whatever approach I take, whether it's, individuals with weight problems, eating disorders, competitors, just the variants. And, of course, in social work, one of my jobs was I had to move back and forth between mindsets. What I mean by that is I had a job where I had to be a life skills counselor for convicts who were being released from prison after long-term sentences, and I had to find them work in the community. So I had to go back and forth between the community mindset and the convicts' mindset and education. And so I was always moving between worlds, and that allowed me to really get even more adept in terms of responding to other people from where they're at, rather than from where I'm at. And I think that's the thing missing in coaching. Everyone wants to talk at their clients rather than communicate with their clients.
I totally agree. Meet them where they're at, right?
Yeah, you have to work with someone from where they're coming from, or you can't really affect change. No one responds well to being lectured to.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think I see that with a lot of my, well, I'm female clients, of course, let's say 35 to 65. And definitely I see one of our biggest beefs is that we're not always being catered to, and there's very few coaches that can cater to. I mean, we are the biggest cohort, I believe, are women 40 to 65 now heading into gyms. But for many of us, we find that we are being fit into a program instead of vice versa. And I think that's one of the things with the majority of coaches out there is they're coming forward saying, this is what you should be doing instead of, tell me about you, tell me about. And so are you a sociologist that is also into fitness, or are you a fitness guy that's a sociologist? Which hat do you wear mostly?
I try not to wear hats that have labels like that. You know, I move well in between worlds, like I said. So, you know, one of my professors once described me as an enigma. So I think that that pretty much fits the coin. And it allows me to be much more dimensional in terms of how I deal with people or the things I see that other people don't see. When I look at research, I'm able to see things that other people may not be able to see, and those kind of things.
Yeah, no doubt. So who's the majority of your female clients, Scott? I know you have a lot of competitors. Could you break it down for us?
Actually, I don't have a lot of competitors anymore. I kind of reject most of the competitors unless they fit certain criteria. That's the only client base where I now have a criteria. I left that world a long time ago.
And why a criteria? Is it because of the unhealthiness?
Me?
Why the criteria? Why, like, what would that be then?
I just think competing in the physique world can be very damaging to the psyche, and a lot of people don't realize it till it's too late. They surrender the things in life that really matter in order to have a better body for a very short period of time. You know, and I've seen relationships dissolve and marriages dissolve, and you know, it just and of course the whole drug scene. As you know, I've been to the top of that mountain. I was like the guy in that world for a long time, and I was a writer for several magazines, had my own column in magazines. I was a ghostwriter for magazines. Basically, what I explain to people in interviews like this is I was at the top of that mountain and took a look from the peak, and I didn't like what I saw. So, you know, I basically left. But as long as competitors now are realistic in terms of expectations and they're not, you know, into the PEDs and stuff, then I'm willing to help them have a great contest experience. But when it's all about the results and it's all about, you know, taking drugs and things like that, then I'm not the right person for someone like that.
Well, and it has certainly exploded too. You know, we see this everywhere. I mean, I competed, 25 years ago, and I was like one out of 10 women competing back then. And then I went into my last show, I decided to throw my hat into the ring in my 50s again just to check it out. 365 competitors.
Yeah, so make no mistake, it's a huge cash cow.
We
have to, you know, I mean, one of the things that struck me as a sociologist when I removed myself from the situation is why? What's the attraction? Why do people want to do this at the expense of their bodies, especially for the females? So there's always this kind of beauty notion that my body is the thing, my body is the thing, my body is the thing. And that can be really damaging if there's no healthy perspective going in. And the people who are attracted to compete in the physique industry, you know, are often borderline personalities to begin with. So this can just thrust them into all kinds of other, you know, issues, metabolic damage and other things when you put your body secondary to the cause at hand, or you listen to coaches that don't have a clue. And you know, when it's all about, you know, how you end up finishing, more can be lost than gained. So I just removed myself from it. I wasn't seeing any value in it for a long time.
Yeah.
People weren't doing it for the same reasons that I was doing it, and I found that very, at first it didn't matter to me, but as a leader it started to affect me. So I was like, well, you know, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem.
Yeah, exactly. And you talk about this a lot in your Empowered Women Experience book, which I love, and you talk about the beauty myth doctrine. And so if you guys haven't read it, you should go to his website and grab it. It is a great book, and you also have your program coming up, which I want to touch on in a bit as well. But I wonder, sometimes we had Gloria Steinem, we had the beauty myth, and we had feminism and women's rights, and I wonder if we're actually turning the tide back again when we see scores of women, you know, beautifying themselves to go into show, like you say, damaging themselves. There's very few healthy competitors out there going into it for the right reasons. Do you think we're turning backward somewhat?
No, absolutely. But we are as a culture. I don't, you know,
yes, right.
The beauty debt, when you read my book, for those who are listening, you'll see that the confines for female, you know, standard of beauty, the ideal, in other words, has got narrower and narrower over time. So it's
thin and pretty, right?
Well, it's what I call life inside the thin cage. People are trying to make themselves fit into something that's very unrealistic expectations. I think it was 1935, 1940, in that area. One of the Miss America winners from that era was 5'4", 135 pounds, and by 2010 she's 5'9", and 110 pounds. So we see that the ideal moves further and further away from what the average women will look like and can expect, and they keep moving away from that because it's a great way to sell products, because what we do now is we socialize females to invest in what I call in the book a beauty debt. So then the beauty debt just means that you internalize from a very young age that you can never be good enough the way you are. And
right.
So that you're always having to buy improvement. You're always having to buy beauty. And the culture has moved more toward self-absorption as well, with selfies. And I think the Kardashians have done a disservice to women globally.
Yes. Famous for being famous, I guess. I don't.
Yeah. I mean, we're all about appearance without substance in this culture. And, that's one of those times where ignorance is bliss, but to anyone with half a conscience, that can be really self-tormenting.
Right, and so in defense of us women who are aging as well, we are certainly in this anti-aging movement, but many women, where's the line between doing something like a cosmetic surgery or, you know, a little bit of lift and tuck or something, and taking it into an unhealthy obsession? Do you feel that there's a place for women to want to beautify in a healthy way, and how does that look?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's such a thing as a healthy vanity. I think what culture does is take anything that has substance and then spins it so that they can sell it. So, you're now selling the sizzle and not the steak.
Right.
And they'll do that with anything that starts out in a pure way. So even they do that with artists. Like, you look at someone like Pink, who was, developed her name and her brand by being an individual and not fitting any molds. And then, fast forward a few years and she's now a cover girl model, same kind of thing. So whatever they can co-opt and then present to women is something they can buy into. There is a source of healthy vanity. I think it becomes unhealthy when people know they have issues because of it. You develop food issues, weight issues, eating issues, then obviously it's gone to another, it's gone into another realm of unhealth. But since the day we were born, in terms of attracting mates and whatnot, there's always going to be what we call a healthy vanity, because that's just our hardwiring to procreate the species. But beyond that, we live in a culture now that wants to really, really kind of, reinforce the unhealthy vanity, because it keeps people as healthy little consumers.
Right. And I see a lot of women going into show, they want to go into show because they want to get fit. And so they're looking at it like, I'm going to be fit and I'm going to, stay that way or whatever. And it just seems to be, for me, I call it almost, it's almost like so many women are doing this as a bucket list thing, which is great. But for me, it was always about the athleticism. It was about performance in the gym. And I think, this is just my opinion, but I think we've moved away from that, whereby you can have a woman on stage in not great conditioning, but she's got God-given shape and a little bit soft here or there, and it seems to be that judging now is based on a lot of that. And I would just love to see the judging on how do they do in the gym, how are they performing, what does it look like. I love your latest blog, by the way, just to digress a bit, in support of bodybuilding. Defending training, bodybuilding, and defending. So if you guys haven't read it, you need to go to his blog and read this, because what I love about that, Scott, is you're saying the athleticism has somewhat been lost towards all of this functional movement, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, but there's been a backlash against bodybuilding and about that performance. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I just got tired of reading. Like you said, I'm a bit of a research junkie, and I moved into some, for a book I was writing, I moved into some research and the strength training arena and all these things. And I just got tired of book after book taking pot shots at bodybuilding and bodybuilding trainers. Now, there's enough room to take pot shots at stereotypes, for sure. But that's true in any realm. There's also, you know, like I said in the article, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. There's a reason that a certain kind of a training produces a certain kind of look and a certain kind of effect, and you're not going to get that by pretending it lies elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And it's just in terms of longevity and safety, that kind of training, body part training, just makes the most sense as we age. There's going to be less wear and tear on the joints, less pounding on the joints. More bone support from training that way, whereas the more ballistic stuff and the CrossFit nonsense and whatnot that invites more issues than it does in terms of promoting health and wellness.
Why do you think we got into this CrossFit? Is it a more is better approach, or I mean, it's become quite a craze? I think they're actually talking about toning it down because they're recognizing it's just too tough on aging bodies.
Oh, they're toning it down for a lot of reasons. Lawsuits.
People are
getting, there's a few quadriplegics out there now because of CrossFit. And I think if you've been around as long as I have, since the 70s, fitness and nutrition tend to go in waves. So they go in sort of five-year cycles. And that just shows that the industry really isn't built on science. It's built on what I call vogueness and voguing. But you'll see both trends tend to go in five-year cycles, and I think what happened now is sort of a delayed reaction to what we were seeing maybe in the 90s with, you know, Suzanne Summers and her Thigh Master, and, you know, Body by Jake with his sit back and relax on my ab, whatever it was. And, you know, the implication was that nothing required any effort, and you could just, you know, ease into these wonderful results that these models had. And I think there was a reaction to that, but now there's been an overreaction to that. So now it's like, instead of training hard, you punish your body and train it into the ground. And not only do you do that, but you do that in front of others and you compete with them at CrossFit or boot camp classes and whatnot. And that's not respecting someone's own body at all. It's objectifying your own body, and for what purpose? So you can keep up with, you know, Mary Jane beside you in a boot camp class? Like, that makes no sense to me. It should be all about progression. It should all be about making personal progress. And that kind of gets lost in the mix when we have this thing now that's like, let's just see how much our body can take, and then we call that healthy.
Yeah, exactly. Where are you when it comes to cardio? I know your metabolic enhancement training. I purchased your program, of course, and I used some of it, some of the moves with my girls, and it was like a mutiny. It was so tough on them. I loved it. I love what you say, you know, burn off the fat, don't starve it off. But so if you could tell my listeners, what's your idea about cardio?
Well, I mean, a lot of this depends. You know, context is everything, and the individual is always the context, and that requires assessment. You know, who am I dealing with right in front of me? Like, am I dealing with someone maybe who is a stay-at-home mom and who's had hormonal issues since giving birth? Am I, you know, dealing with a 26-year-old former athlete who was a, you know, female track star? You know, there's all that kind of metabolic context to consider, but in my book, The Able Approach, as well as in my upcoming Empowered Woman course, there's a whole section on the uselessness of steady-state cardio for fat burning and for metabolic effects, actually. Steady-state cardio in a diet, in the context of a deprivation diet, can actually promote metabolic damage and fat storing, and making someone down the line even fatter than they normally would have been. And I got a litany of studies I can quote on that.
Is that because the body gets used to it, or because you're shaving off muscle? Like, what?
Well, everything we do is programming our bodies as this fantastic computer that we have, right? So everything we do along those lines, put into our mouth and do with training, is telling our bodies to do a certain thing. And when you do cardio, it's all about getting more fuel efficient in terms of fat fuel. Now that sounds good on the, you know, that sounds really good on the outside, but you know, what does that actually mean? Well, if you look at what that actually means in terms of function, you become more fuel efficient with fat. Well, if you
right.
look at cars that are fuel efficient, you get more miles to the gallon. That's why you bought them. So you're actually preserving fat energy the more you do cardio. You surrendering less of it and storing it more efficiently. That's what fuel efficiency means.
And we don't want to be efficient, right?
Well, you don't want to be so efficient that you're
yeah.
that you're preserving body fat and not
yeah.
burning it. So it becomes the law of diminishing returns. And, you know, before we're 30 minutes of cardio for 6 weeks got you somewhere. Now you need 40 minutes for 8 weeks, and then you need, you know, on and on and on. So it gets to be the law of diminishing returns, which is, you know, useless.
And I see this a lot with women my age still. It's amazing. They're still in the cardio queen approach. And it's
yeah.
very, very tough for me to break them from that because they've had to feed this machine and do more and more cardio, and then they try to cut calories, but cardio doesn't carve. It just, you know, it makes you a smaller version. But at our age, we get looser with time as well. So I always say to them, what do you want? I mean, if you want to run a marathon, then, yeah, you're going to have to put in your miles. But if you want to build and carve and shape and rearrange and get stronger, then you have to put it by the wayside. But it's tough. It's tough for me to try to convince women who are hooked on cardio or they want to do it. So if a woman comes to you and she's a cardio queen, she says, Scott, I really want to change my shape. What's the first thing? Do you lower her cardio? How do you mentally as well as physically get her into the groove?
Well, first, you know, again, I got to do an assessment, and I would never try to convince someone to give up activities that they enjoy. But a lot of times they don't know any different. So, you know, they're just doing what they know. And, they're, you know, there's that fear factor for women, again. They're afraid of giving up cardio because, oh, my God, if I can barely maintain my
yeah.
body fat status with cardio, what's it going to be like without it? You know, it's this, like all stinking. But, you know, if you allow me to go off on a tangent, I just pulled up some studies I can quote to you if you'd
Please.
Like to hear. Just, I mean, this is just off the top of my head from my Empowered Woman course. So International Journal of Sports Nutrition, September 1998 issue, they tested the hypothesis, does adding aerobic exercise burn more fat? The study looked at the addition of 45 minutes of aerobic exercise. The findings of this study were that 45 minutes of aerobic exercise at 78% maximum heart rate, 5 days a week for 12 straight weeks, okay, had no effect over dieting alone on promoting fat loss. So
wow.
that's a four-month waste of training time since it had no effect on fat loss. The Journal of Clinical Endocrine Metabolism from January 2007 tested this hypothesis. What is the effect of diet plus aerobic training on body composition? The findings of this study were that 50 minutes of aerobic training performed 5 days per week over 6 months, half a year, had no additional effects on body composition. Therefore, that's 6 months wasted time of training if fat loss is the goal or maintaining leanness. In the journal Obesity from 2007, the hypothesis that they tested was, what are the exercise effects on weight and body fat in men and women? And this was a one-year study, a 12-month study. It took a whole year. They looked at 6 hours of aerobic training per week, 1 hour a day, 6 days a week, so only 1 day off. And the average weight loss was 0.5 pounds per month. So someone lost 8 ounces in a month. And the researchers in this study noted that the results were even poorer for the women in the study. So not only did the men not do well with the aerobic training, but the women did even worse.
Wow.
So, you know, I follow up that with the question, you know, these studies clearly show that aerobic training has basically a nil effect on fat loss and body comp, then what's the difference on doing it on an empty stomach? The whole non-fed, you know, mm-hmm. cardio myth. Mm-hmm. And then in the journal Metabolism, and a really, really good journal, from 1994, study was the impact of exercise intensity on body fatness and skeletal muscle metabolism. And the hypothesis there was, does more calories burned during training yield more fat loss? Because most people get on those ellipticals and they keep clicking on their calories burned, calorie consumption, right?
As if the machine knows.
What's that?
As if the machine knows.
Yeah, as if the machine knows. So this study looked exactly like that. Does more calories burned during training yield more fat loss? This study looked at 20 weeks of endurance training of cardio versus 15 weeks, so 5 weeks less training of interval training, and with weights. And the findings were that while the interval group burned less calories during the training, this group also showed 9 times greater fat loss than the cardio-only group.
Beautiful.
So the strength density training, like that MET is composed of,
yeah,
is far more efficient for toning and burning fat. So, and then, you know, I mean, I can go on and on. These are just a few of the studies from my Empowered Woman course on the aerobic myth. I call it the aerobic
right.
myth.
Yeah, right. And then, in all honesty, the MET training is pretty tough stuff, too.
It doesn't have to be. Like, those are program specific, right? So
right,
a lot
right.
of the times I wrote some of the harder programs to sort of make a point. But I have over 700 programs. So, like I said, if someone hires me, and let's say it's someone listening to this from your group, and let's say she's pushing 50 and she hasn't been active in a long time, and she's got, you know, wants to lose 40, 50 pounds or whatever. Well, I don't throw her into the Ultimate Figure program. I give her, you know, maybe a program based in biplexes and a few days a week and
right.
this kind of thing. So, it's very important. And then, you know, just let me throw in one more study here because I want to talk a little bit about metabolism as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the National Institute of Health, which is there is no more better respected agency for studying stuff like this, is the NIH. They did a study in a really elaborate facility that uses a room calorimeter that measures oxygen uptake and respiration rates of people over a 24-hour period. And the study here, that what's interesting is they tested ultramarathon runners and triathletes. So we're talking the very best of the best in terms of endurance and cardio specific. And they tested them against average couch potatoes. And what they found was there was absolutely no difference in metabolism in a 24-hour period when vital stats were controlled. So in other words, even in endurance athletes at the very highest level of performance who do the most volume of work, like training for triathlons and marathons, they don't get a metabolic payoff for doing that kind of exercise. They only burn more calories because they're doing more and more of it longer and longer. But if you're a person with a real life and a real job, you're not going to be able to go out for 3-hour runs and 4-hour bike rides and, you know, things like that. So you want to look at something that has a metabolic payoff, something that has, you know, sort of what I call optimizing a robust metabolism rather than the current vogue, if you follow what goes on out there, is to actually depress metabolism and suppress metabolism and make it very sluggish over time, which defeats the purpose of why someone's dieting to begin with.
Right. Let's talk food then while we're talking about dieting.
Okie dokie.
A big topic. I think it's probably bigger for most women than training because the training, you can set an hour around it or whatever, 30, 45 minutes around it, 4 to 5 days a week. But the eating's all around us. And there's this, I have girls, I always say to them, if you're going to come on board with me, you're going to turn off the internet. You're going to turn away from well-meaning family and friends because there's so much info out there, but it's not knowledge-based. And I truly do believe in majority of times that experience can trump so-called science, because there's not a lot of us that have been around that long. But when it comes to eating, what's the biggest issue facing women? I'm talking physically and mentally and spiritually as well. What do you see women challenged with the most?
Well, the biggest difference for women between training and eating is emotion.
Right.
For women, the training, whether they're misinformed about cardio or not, it still lacks the emotional impact that food and diet has on them. That's for some reason. Well, there's all kinds of reasons, and that would take a whole other interview, but women have injected emotion into the notion of diet and nutrition. So there's a whole emotional component there that really shouldn't be there because it goes against the emotion that is there is from what I call the North American diet mentality that has people internalize a very unnatural fear of food. If you look at my book, Beyond Metabolism, Understanding Metabolism, you'll see that our brains evolved and all mammalian species evolved to have a positive emotional experience with the eating experience, not with food per se, but with the actual eating experience. Right from the minute a mother nurses an infant and makes eye contact, there's emotional connection in a positive way there that is
right.
Now connected into your emotional hardwiring for the rest of your life. You are meant to look at the eating experience in a very positive and soothing way. And what the North American diet mentality does is takes that away from people and makes them fear food through diets and body weight and things like that, which is very unnatural. So it makes you have a sort of ongoing battle with your own brain. But you can't win a battle with your own instinctual drives to survive. So it's very unnatural to fear food, to be afraid of food, to rule out certain foods as bad, you know, labeling foods as good and bad, things like that. It just gives women a whole head full of bad wiring, you know, and it's something that they need to get over.
So how do we rewire? What do we do?
Well,
how do we look at food? I mean, food is an enjoyable process, and I always say you can't build and change your physique without food, and so many women are trying to stay at 16% body fat and still change their bodies. So you're right, they're in a constant war with it, but what do we do?
Well, we got to put right side up what's upside down. So
uh-huh.
we got to stop thinking that the answer lies with food and diets.
Right.
We got to get over what I call stinking thinking. And, you know, the phrase to embrace is that mindset determines behavior, or more importantly, quality of mindset determines quality of behavior. So when you correct the way you think and feel about food and diet, then behavior follows suit. It's never the other way around, even though the diet and fitness industry wants people to believe it is, that if you just go eat this way,
yeah, exactly.
Then your mind will orient accordingly. No, it won't. Your mind has an instinctual drive to enjoy food. So when you tell it, your mind to avoid certain foods, it's going to rebel against that. So it's just very, very unnatural the way the North American diet mentality works. So it's first of all, you got to teach people to understand that. Then you got to teach them to embrace it. And those are two different things. But awareness comes first.
That could take a lifetime, hey? I mean, honestly, for some women, just to have them come back to enjoy food, there's a lifetime of them denying themselves.
Well, that's what I, you know, I mean, that's the whole idea about train the person, not the program, is we've got to
right.
get over this denial and deprivation mindset that hurts
right.
our notions of self-respect and self-esteem. It doesn't help us. And then when you throw in things like guilt and shame surrounding food or diet adherence,
yeah.
guilt and shame have never been proven to be motivating factors for
yeah.
achievement. They're actually the opposite. They're what leads to self-sabotage over and over again. But what do we keep teaching people, you know, is that, you know, failure is not an option, and if you're not perfect, then you're a failure, and with diet and stuff like this. So you end up catching someone in the whole shame and guilt cycle, and all that does is perpetuate, you know, failure over and over again and perpetuate obsessing about food over and over again.
Right, and so they reach for food for comfort because they feel like a failure.
And their minds maybe rebel against the whole diet mentality as well. And when you rebel against it, you have those moments where you okay, I'm going to eat as much as I can while my willpower is down, and then I'll get back on it on, you know, Monday
yes,
or Tuesday
exactly.
or whatever. So as we see there again, what it's reinforcing is what I say in the Empowered Woman course is you got to understand you don't have a food or weight problem. You have a thinking and feeling problem about food and your weight.
Right.
So once people get that first the awareness part and then the embracing part, then and only then will things change in a sustainable way. Sure, we can do short-term, we can all do short-term changes, and, you know, part of the way this industry perpetuates this nonsense is before and after pictures on these sites,
mm-hmm.
which really should be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the after pictures?
Mm-hmm.
So we have the before and after picture.
Yeah.
Well, what about 6 months after the
yeah.
after picture, you know? Someone so envious of, you know, the figure girl in their gym who's about to compete, and, oh, you know, you look so wonderful, you look so great. Check them out again 8 months later.
Exactly. I call them the before and way after photos. So,
well,
I
yeah,
want
and
a girl 2 or 3 years down the road and see how it is. But yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, and in my Empowered Women course, there's a whole section on metabolic damage and before and as you would say, way after pictures. And in my book, Metabolic Damage and the Dangers of Dieting, we posted some pictures in there as well. And it's no one wants to talk about that. We want to glorify the short term and pretend that it's sustainable long term when it's actually setting the body up to react in very, very violent ways.
So I know you're a guy that hates labels, so I'm going to throw some at you.
Okay.
When we talk about, because it's all out there, I had people saying to me, you know, what's your diet plan? I say, I'm not going to tell you what to eat. I'm going to show you how to eat. But paleo, if it fits your macros, high-fat ketone, what's the other one that's out there?
They're all out there.
Dieting. So what do you do? What do you say?
Well, what do you say to all of those? In my book, Understanding Metabolism, I pretty much explained why all of those fad diets are
just annihilate
fat.
Them?
Well, let's say I lay them to rest.
Okay.
I don't have a wake for them, but it's just too bad that people buy into all this nonsense. Paleo is particularly nonsensical. It's just a variation of Atkins, which was dangerous enough
totally
in itself.
Agree. Yeah.
And, you know, our Paleolithic ancestors weren't lean, they were skinny. And they weren't skinny because of what they ate. They were skinny because of how they had to live, fighting for survival. They didn't have, you know, heat-controlled homes, and they didn't have microwaves and stoves and fridges, you know. So the metabolic and caloric demands for survival for Paleolithic man had nothing to do with what their body composition looked like. And lo and behold, there's also plenty of proof that they actually did eat starches of various forms when they could find them. It was a matter of finding them. So, you know, a lot of this stuff go beyond the real misrepresented research and look at the arguments, and they really make no sense at all. Mm-hmm. I have a blog coming up on intermittent fasting. Do you know who the number one examples of intermittent fasting across the globe have been for the last 50 years? There's two different ones, but one really represents what I would like to get at.
It would have to be a tribe, I would assume.
Well, there's one more obvious than that practice intermittent fasting the way it's been advocated in North American circles. There's a certain group that practices skipping breakfast and then training on an empty stomach, deliberately to make them more hungry so they can eat more and more, and then deliberately eat before bed and eat within that certain window. And it produces a very specific look. Do you know who eats that way?
No.
Sumo wrestlers.
You're kidding.
No, look it up.
Seriously?
Absolutely, yeah. So they deliberately eat that way so that they can put on more and more central obesity because that's what gives them the leverage in the sumo
ring.
Yeah.
I know John Romaniello also talks a lot about skipping breakfast and all that kind of stuff. Okay, go into that for me. I don't understand how that can work.
Well, it doesn't work. That's the whole point. If you want to look like a sumo wrestler, adopt intermittent fasting. And
Why does that happen is what I'm saying. Why does it go the other way to put weight on?
Oh, it's biochemistry. You put your body into a fat storing mode. Basically, you like I said earlier, everything we put into our mouths and how we exercise is programming our computer to do something specific. Mm-hmm. In this sense, by skipping breakfast regularly and only eating within a certain time frame and eating as much as you can within that time frame, you create this very, very adaptable fat storing machine. So your body, you prime your body to store fat by skipping breakfast, so you're going longer and longer in the catabolic phase or the using phase of energy metabolism. And then you train on the empty stomach to, multiply that effect. And then when you eat, your body wants to store all that as fat because it senses a lack of energy coming in. Now, that's just the biochemistry of the fat storing machinery. That doesn't even address the reward centers of the brain and how they react to not being fed.
Well, where do calories fit in all this, though, Scott? Like, because a lot of people say, it's all about calories in, calories out. Are you on intermittent fasting? Are you actually taking in more calories? And could that be because of the could that be causing a fat surplus?
Well, it's programming your body to store fat, period.
So more about programming is overriding the amount of calories, because so many people look at it as a mathematical equation.
Well, and it's not. I mean, in my book, Understanding Metabolism, if you move into, if it fits your macros, you know, we explain how and why for certain people. If you light up the reward centers of the brain that way by having a snack-sized Snickers bar or whatever, you're never properly taking control of the reward centers of your brain. So you're basically just constantly teasing yourself. You know, for people who are prone to that. And in terms of cosmetic advantage, it makes no sense at all.
Right, right.
You know, as someone who formerly competed, no one ever dieted to compete by eating snack-sized Snickers bars and and things like that. There's certain foods that you eat because they are what we call, quote-unquote, cosmetically friendly. We eat them to produce a certain effect, and there's no difference here. The other form of intermittent fasting that's out there is Ramadan. And I've trained many, many Muslim clients who, for the month of Ramadan, they can't eat from light till dusk. And ask them if they want to continue on that form of intermittent fasting after a couple of weeks. I mean, it just destroys them in terms of health and well-being. And there's a reason it's called a religious sacrifice, because it feels like one.
Right. And that's why they do it. So where are you when it comes to macros then, Scott? What's your belief around macros?
It's what I call the illusion of control. It's much ado about nothing. Basically, this industry wants to teach us that the more and more of the stuff we obsess about in control, then, you know, the more in control we are. But the body body knows what it's doing. It knows what it wants to do. So
but
it's really not.
Pay attention, do you not, to macros? Do you not have to pay attention to getting quality fats, making sure you have your protein? How do you go into it and feed your body well without being a slave to it?
Well, that's just the thing. I mean, when you start crunching numbers, you're a slave to it. Portion sizes alone is about as much as anyone really. If you boil it down to portion sizes and you know, protein sparing nutrients and portion sizes, then you really is all the attention that it really needs. And as I said also in my book, Understanding Metabolism, you know, I think you could boil down every reputable textbook ever written on nutrition to Michael Pollan's 7 words.
Oh, yeah. Eat plants.
Eat food, not a lot, mostly plants.
Plants, yeah, brilliant.
And this whole stuff about macros is ridiculous. Like, am I suddenly in the getting lean zone if I'm 35-35-30, but I'm out of that zone if I'm 35-45-10? Like, it just is nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it offers the illusion of control.
Right.
So
when somebody comes to you, you're not going to lay out calories, you're not going to lay out specific percentages of macros.
I haven't dealt with calories in years because it makes no sense to, you know, calories is an outside-in illusion of control of not listening to your body.
Right.
What I try to get people to do is develop an inside-out appreciation to listening to their body. And then that's what they learn. Like, yes, they get a diet from me, and it'll have portion control, but if they want to go on to, you know, Fit Day or all the rest and figure out their actual calories, they're welcome to, but it doesn't have much meaning to me, and the research is showing over and over again that it's really, there's really more to metabolism, much more to metabolism than all that stuff. And, I mean, it's just nonsensical to think that 100 calories of broccoli is the same effects in your body as 100 calories of, you know, peanut brittle or, candy floss.
Yeah, exactly.
So the app thing
drives me crazy. I have so many people that use apps and they want to know their exactly caloric intake, and I'm like, oh, man. Put away the app if you want to put pencil to paper. That's how we did it, just to get a feel for, you know, even on the eating 5 to 6 times a day, are you crazy? It sends me into chaos. I'm fine on 3 times a day and maybe something after a workout. Where are you on the meal thing? Again, you're flexible with it, right?
It depends on the client and it's all assessing what I call the need state. What is my client's need state?
Right.
You know, I'm in big favor of more frequent feedings of less amount of food, because your body just deals with it more efficiently. Mm-hmm. But that's not a categorical thing to paint everyone with the same brush by any means. Mm-hmm. But it's very good to keep metabolism humming along rather
right.
than, you know, the more frequently you go without food intake, the more you risk your metabolism down-regulating to compensate for that. So, but it depends on a lot of things. Like, there's a lot of RMR factors there to consider, resting metabolic rate factors, mm-hmm. in terms of age, gender, and height and weight specifically.
Right.
They have a lot to do with, assessing metabolism. Mm-hmm. And, again, it goes way, way beyond counting calories. Counting calories is for neophytes or people who are obsessed. But offering meal plans, that's a whole different thing. I mean, there's relevance to that, of course.
Yeah, right. With women, do you find, I mean, for me in my 50s and when I was in my 20s, I don't see my metabolisms change much, but I've kept up with the training and the eating throughout the years. Do you think that women's metabolisms, necessarily changes as we age? We're all in this aging thing where, oh, yeah, I'm over 40 or I'm over 50. I'm naturally going to get achy. I'm naturally going to gain more weight. What's your take on that as far as how much we do, in fact, change and what we can do about it?
Well, yeah, there you just answered the question. It's like these changes are inevitable, of course, but does that mean you're helpless against them? Well, no, you can do things to offset them or delay them or make their impacts less impactful. Like you said, you trained all the way through and you ate well all the way through. So, you know, that's you know, having a sort of being prepared, right? And,
yeah.
you know, that's like having ammunition, but, you know, that's how to do it. But these things are definitely inevitable. I mean, I'm in my 50s, and I'm not the same guy I was when I was, you know, a physique model in the magazines and stuff, and I don't pretend to be. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
And for the life of me, you know, when I get clients my age who struggle, I mean, it just reinforces to me that I wouldn't trade the wisdom of age for the physique of youth any day.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm happy camper spiritually and otherwise where I'm at right now, thank you. So, but yeah, I mean, these changes are certainly inevitable, and they're certainly proven in research. I mean, menopause, et cetera, and, you know, the hormonal effects and things like that. But there are things that can exacerbate those changes and make them heavier on the negative side, and there are things that can offset those changes and make them more on the positive side or the less negative side. So that's all about healthy lifestyle. But healthy lifestyle also has to do with how you look at things.
Totally, yes. Living from the inside out, I call it.
Absolutely, and that has to do with a lot of things like sleep and worry and stress. And, you know, if you're going to lose sleep and stress and worry over things like diet and food, then I wouldn't call that a very healthy person.
Yeah, I read that that's a very good point.
Look good on the outside, but
you're crap on the inside.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I have, I don't have a lot of young women on my program because I do promote to the 40-plus woman, but when I do, it's because they're now saying, I want to look good in my 40s and 50s like the rest of you guys. And so that's really nice to see that a lot of the younger women are recognizing we got to start now, whereas when I get women coming to me in their 40s or 50s that have not had the exercise or healthy eating background, it's a tough road. And I always say, you know, the earlier you start, the better. And, again, if you can maintain it, you're going to have less of a dip, I guess, as you get older.
Yeah,
sure.
You know, and eventually it's all about how you treat yourself. And, you know, as I say over and over in the book that you probably got tired of reading, but, for women, it's about understanding that your body was meant to be your lifelong partner, not your lifelong project.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
When you can embrace that and get over the nonsense and just age beautifully, you know, to this day, I mean, it's something I've said since I started doing workshops and seminars all over the world, but, you know, I've always said there's nothing sexier than a woman who knows who she is and what she's about. I mean, and that doesn't come in a size, in a dress size.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's usually people who are self-nurturing and self-accepting that just sort of glow that, and you know, that has an immense draw to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tell us about your cheat day and your cycle diet. I did watch one of your videos. Who's that gentleman that you're with? And he went over his menu for the day of what he ate.
Oh, that's just one of many. That's Kevin. Oh. He lives close by. He's a good friend of mine. He's a 2-time world champion powerlifter,
yeah.
And he's a national champion bodybuilder, natural. So I have tremendous respect for him. And he was doing a version of the Cycle Diet. My book on Amazon, The Cycle Diet, has sort of been upgraded from a lecture I did over 10 years ago. And basically, the Cycle Diet is how, when, and why cheat days work to your advantage to keep weight off and optimize metabolism. So too many times we have, cheat day is used as a buzzword. Oh, it's my cheat day. Oh, it's my cheat meal. One of my clients ended up joining with me after the last Empowered Women course, and she wrote me and said she used to be part of Weight Watchers, and she was out to dinner with all these ladies who were over 100 pounds overweight, and they were all in a restaurant going on about their cheat days. Well, that's just ridiculous. When you have that, you have to be in a certain mode, what I call super compensation mode. It's a certain metabolic phase that you have to achieve. When you achieve that phase metabolically, then it actually serves your body to overeat in a specific window of time because your body super compensates to where it needs most, and that would be to replenish glycogen stores, increase leptin levels. Leptin is the hormone responsible for burning body fat. When you diet, you depress and suppress leptin levels, and so you get, that's the way your body sort of adapts to the lack of incoming energy. So when you reach supercompensation mode, it actually behooves you to overeat. And in the book, The Cycle Diet, I talk about studying people who compete in eating contests, and there's a tiny little thing they call the Black Widow. Young to me, a lady who competes in eating contests, and she just, she's like lean, 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 tiny, 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 and yet she can eat like 9 pounds of cheesecake at a time and things like this. So instead of, here we go again, instead of fearing food and I can only have a little of this and only have a little of that, I believe in reality, and I believe in living in the world that we live in means accepting that we live in a world of abundance, and we should be able to enjoy that abundance guilt-free. So if we want to do that, and if we want to indulge in foods that we enjoy, then let's achieve a certain metabolic profile where when we do indulge in those what we call cheat days, then there's no cosmetic consequences for that. There's actually benefits for it. Mm-hmm. So for me, it can vary. What I have, what I have can vary week to week. I can eat a dozen donuts at a time. I can eat a whole sweet potato pie with whipped cream at a time. And of course, if you've seen me, I'm very lean and in shape and stuff. And I've been following the Cycle Diet for over 30 years. And the reason I like the Cycle Diet is because it was born in the real world of experience. It wasn't born in a library reference room.
Yes.
What I mean by that is I started to reverse engineer what I, as a naive competitor, when I first started competing, what I was witnessing backstage and stuff made no sense to me because I'm watching guys eat chocolate covered in honey and they're drinking wine, and all the stuff they couldn't have while they were dieting to get lean was all of a sudden, good in the short term to make their physiques look better.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, how does that work? And how long does it work? And why would it work? And, over the years, I did it myself. And then there was the whole post-competition thing, which you've experienced, I'm sure, where for the next couple of days you eat whatever you want, and there's no consequences to it. You actually look better and better, and you think, wow, this is great, until it stops working.
Yeah.
And that's what I call super compensation mode. So
right.
What I realized is you could just stay in that mode. Once you get to that mode where your body wants the inundation of calories, then you can just stay there if you know how to, it's called a cycle diet, because then you learn how to cycle what I call underfeeds with overfeeds.
Mm-hmm.
And then it works really, really beneficially to keep you lean and keep the weight off. It's actually when you're trying to continually deprive yourself of calories that your body, the metabolic compensation system, compensates by down-regulating the rate at which you burn calories. And like I said, your leptin levels get depressed, your ghrelin levels go up, which is your hunger levels, all these things, which is why diets don't work in the long term.
Right.
So the cycle diet, and the other thing about the cycle diet is that it's a fun way to live in the real world. I'm not, it's never going to be one to pretend that I'm never going to eat another piece of birthday cake again, and I'm never going to eat this again, and I'm never going to eat that again. And, I think that's a silly way to approach living in a world of abundance that we're so blessed to have, that we should be enjoying that. And it caters to, like I said, our brain evolved to the reason that restaurants and things like that exploded for the human condition is because it caters to our instinctual drive to enjoy the eating experience. Mm-hmm. So to try to nullify that is to go against our own biological drives. It just makes no sense.
But it takes a long, long time for you as a coach to come to know your client with in respect to the cheat day and the cycle diet and the overcompensation. But also as an individual, like I always say to women, this is what you're learning is your most important relationship, you with you. And I don't want to tell you what to do. I can kind of lead you, but you have to come to know how is it for you working with somebody with a cheat day and a cycle diet? You know you've been doing this for 30 years, but how do you pass that on to other people so they can fly on their own?
Well, because I've been doing it for 30 years, I've also been training, thousands of people for 30 years too. So I'm pretty adept at reading metabolisms of other people. I don't just assign everybody the cycle diet. That's what I was kind of getting at before. It depends where they're at and what their need state is. And if they have food issues, the last thing you want to do is try to convince them of cheat days if they have, emotional issues around food. That's not going to work. So it's about individual interaction and assessment. I think the one thing people are missing is the value of coaching and all this. Coaching is ongoing interaction and troubleshooting, and you can't underestimate the value of that. The problem with so many people is they, like you said, they want to do an internet search and find the answer on a piece of paper, and, I'm going to follow, I'm going to follow this diet over here because this girl lost 20 pounds on it. And, the real value in coaching is in the one-to-one constant interaction where people end up, I call it excavating their essence. They end up peeling back layers of the onion, and they find out that, what they thought was the initial problem really isn't. There was something a little deeper that they never addressed, which is why they never got anywhere. And, that kind of stuff reveals itself. But actually assessing metabolism is pretty easy for me right now in terms of, if someone joins with me, like I said, I don't just consider, are they ready for the cycle diet? That doesn't even cross my mind. I do the assessment on the person first and determine what their need state is and, assign training and the diet strategy accordingly. I don't even call it a diet. I call it a diet strategy.
Right.
And then we work from there. But, I call also my coaching approach is what I call the triangle of awareness. And the triangle of awareness is all about an equal-sided isosceles triangle of mental, emotional, and physical behavioral. So if you look at an isosceles triangle, there's three balanced sides that all touch each other. So if you want to be holistic, then your emotional fitness, your mental fitness, and your behavioral physical fitness, they have to be in concert. If one of them is skewed or obtuse, then the rest is out of balance. So, we kind of look at that and say sometimes where the need state is more on the emotional side than the physical side.
Oh, I would think it would be for most people. I think
but a lot of people keep thinking they're going to solve emotional fitness issues with physical fitness results. And, not to quote Dr. Phil, but how's that working for you?
Oh, you watch him too, do you?
Oh, God, no.
Oh, come on.
He's not as bad as Dr. Oz, I'll give you that.
Oh, thank you for that. Oh, my gosh. Yes, Dr. Oz, I think he's done worse. My girls all know I rant about him. If you want to really take your training and eating back 20 years, go watch Dr. Oz. It just drives me crazy. But I think this is the mentality that we're in, and I totally agree with what you said at the beginning of the interview. We're all about sound bites and all about selfies and that kind of thing, and it drives me crazy when I hear people say, I'm going to go have my cheat meal, or, you haven't earned it. You're not doing it. It's a tool. It's a very specific tool.
Okay.
But I also love what I think I hear you say. You might not have said it, but what I always say to my women is most times experience trumps science.
There's
out there, but it just experience and coming to know your body and you having dealt with thousands of people over the years, you become a master at it. That's where I'd like my clients to get to, is just having a little piece of that mastery.
Yeah, four decades now, and there's a couple of quotes I use about experience trumping science, and one of them is, in professional athletics, I've never seen a coach on the sidelines wearing a lab coat. And one of the other quotes I like to use in terms of reinforcing what you said about experience trumps research is there's an old Tao expression that says, if you want to know the best way up the mountain, ask the man who travels it every day, not the man who stays at the bottom and studies it.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Can I see
so,
that?
So, you know, there's way too much, I call it science reliance. And, you know, good research and experts, what I say is I always say research informs me. It doesn't dictate to me. Mm-hmm. So there's been many times over a four-decade career that I've been way ahead of the research and been attacked for the things I've been saying. And then, you know, 25 years later, the research comes out and proves me right. So, but you have to have a pretty big set of you-know-what to do that.
And you do.
Well, I'm just, you know, I trust my intuition, which is something, what you're talking about actually is teaching others to trust their intuition. I mean, we have this amazing ability inside ourselves if we just trusted it. But, you know, culture wants to more and more tell us that we can't trust our intuition and our instincts.
Yeah.
And
we have to factor it out and pay somebody for it for sure.
Yeah, and, you know, the one of the things I say in one of my other books, The Able Approach, is the really good coaches are the ones who are trying to put themselves out of business with a client. So, you know, you want to make coaching unnecessary. It starts, coaching should be something that...
you work yourself out of a job.
Yeah, first the coach, yeah, exactly. And it starts as being a guiding light, and it ends up being more of a mirror.
Yeah,
then
totally
you only
agree.
Get that through, you know, the right kind of interaction. Because, you know, one of the things I ask people mentoring students and whatnot is, you know, what industry are you in if you're an online coach in this industry? And they will almost always say the fitness industry.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a coach dealing with one-to-one, that's not the industry you're in. That's the vehicle you drive. The industry you're in is something else. That industry is you are in a service industry. You're providing a service to someone. So what does that mean? Well, it's all about communication skills, and it's all about psychology. So you have to know, you know, that when you're working with people, that's the industry you're in. I work with people. You know, it's like someone who loves fitness. You know how many times I've seen this scenario I'm about to tell you, but people I know in my, you know, for the last 30, 40 years who absolutely love fitness, so they open a gym. Well, those are two different worlds. That's
sure.
You're now in a business that is a total different thing than your love for fitness. And almost all of them, of course, go under because they don't understand demographics. They don't understand service. They don't know, oh, I love fitness. I'm going to open a gym. Wrong.
I think it was Schwarzenegger that said, somebody said to him, why don't you open up your own chain of fitness and gyms? And he said, why do I want to do that?
Yeah.
And it's just the perfect answer, but it's true because it takes it to a totally different level for sure and a totally different set of skills as well. And there's a lot of online training now going on, like a lot of, I have my own brand, you have your own brand, but everybody's doing online training, and it kind of it drives me crazy, and I'm very vocal about it, because online training is not doing a workout program and emailing it to somebody.
Well, they're doing
they don't get it.
Like you said, all these people are doing online training. The problem is they're not doing it well.
That's right.
So what they're doing is they're diluting the whole word coach, and the problem for me is that consumers don't know what that word means anymore.
No, thank
you
much
for that. They're using the word coach for someone I wouldn't pay to carry my gym bag.
Yeah.
So, you know, and because someone won a contest or won two contests, that doesn't mean they have suddenly been struck by lightning and impart knowledge to someone else on what their needs may be for the next year or 2 years or 3 years. That's all that means is they showed up on stage one day and they were better than everyone else in terms of leanness.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't just imbue someone with sudden knowledge, you know what I mean? So there's this whole, like I said, appearance trumps substance. And again, if you know how to market and the internet and all that stuff, then you know, there's a lot of boneheads out there that, you know, have a bigger following than I have, and they do better than I do, but at the same time, they're diluting the two words that matter the most, expertise and coaching.
Yeah, no, definitely. Tell us about your Empowered Women program.
Well, it started out as a book that really burned me out doing. I mean, it sort of progressed chronologically. I mean, when I was first in the industry on the competitive side, there was no such thing as figure in bikini, so that's how far back I go, and I know you go as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when figure in bikini exploded, so did metabolic damage and eating disorders and things like this. So first I started with the research on all that, on the physical side of it, metabolic damage and the dangers of dieting and eating disorders and body image and all these things. But there's still, like you said, the last show, like 360 female competitors. So, you know, that got me into the, okay, why are people want to be in denial of all these things and still willing to do this, you know, and live in denial of the potential consequences. So that got me into all these other arenas. And being a sociologist, of course, I looked at it from the cultural societal point of view. And so that book took me almost 3 years to research and write. And then we turned it into a 20-week course, because the 20-week Empowered Woman Experience course has five different modules. It has a cultural module, emotional fitness module, mental fitness module, physical fitness module, which is where the aerobic myth stuff is, and the final, the spiritual fitness module. So it's about as in-depth as any course can get, and I, you know, put my heart and soul into it. So we're re-releasing that in a while on my site, and we're even going to make it available for affiliate, you know, so people can, you know, advocate the course and you know, make money doing it. I'm not doing that as a money making machine. I'm doing it to get it out there that, you know, let's address all these elements of fitness, and let's address all these elements where, you know, the message that you're not good enough the way you are comes from, and why and how you internalize that, and what the consequences are for internalizing that. Let's start there, and let's start with why this is a female issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you read the book, so you know there's a lot of stuff in there, like before the global touch of the internet in certain third world countries, there was no such thing as eating disorders or, you know, psychological, you know, doctors for counseling for eating disorders and body image issues. And when the internet reached these places, then anxiety disorders and eating disorders exploded in terms of, because they bought into what I call the beauty debt and the beauty myth. So we see on a cultural level that, you know, this constant bombarding of women with an ideal image that's virtually impossible to sustain unless you're just naturally genetically gifted for that, which every generation has someone who is. You know, that produces all kinds of psychological torment, which can come out in all kinds of other ways. So I just wanted to address, you know, how to make someone healthy again and whole, and, you know, how to look at things from a more spiritual fitness kind of approach.
And when will that be coming out, Scott?
I think Mike is saying by the end of November. I mean, God bless him. He retooled all of it and
yeah,
put it all together as a course, and it's there, it's waiting. It's just, I think, some final touches and whatnot. And, you know, 20 weeks is a long time, so before I ran the course live, and a lot of people fell behind because the real world and demands,
yeah,
on the real world, people don't, you know, 5 months, you know, 20 weeks is a long time. So
yeah,
this way, the way we're doing it now, people can work at their own speed. So, you know, they get
okay,
dripped.
So it'll be self-directed then. If they miss it, they can hold off the week before they get the next lesson, kind of thing.
Yeah, they'll okay, they'll get every week. There's 20 weeks altogether in 5 4-week modules,
mm-hmm,
and they'll get them dripped 1 week at a time, but they can work on them at their own speed, so they don't. And there'll be a private Facebook group where women can go in and interact. And I'm deliberately keeping that to women only, so they can go in and you know, no holds barred, kind of,
yeah,
share with each other, that kind of thing. Kind of like what you're doing, but
yeah,
it'll be reflective of the course itself, which covers a lot of things. It covers eating disorders. It covers, you know, parental backgrounds. It covers weight issues and you know, stinking thinking issues and, you know, mental fitness and everything that someone can put together to just be, you know, get on a little better in the world, you know, without being told what to think.
Yes. You'll let me know when that comes out? Well, I'm on your blog anyways.
Yeah,
you'll
see it. Yeah, and it's ready, and you know, like I said, I want to get it out there to as many people as possible. So
beautiful.
That's why we're offering it as an affiliate, so people can recommend it and, you know, earn something for doing so, just because I believe in the message. So, and I didn't know how to do all that before, and that's something that Mike takes care
right.
of.
Right, and we need the power of the internet to do that, right? That's how people like you and I can get out there and reach people in all corners of the world. That's the only way to do it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, sometimes that part of, I mean, for so long I resisted it at my own expense. I resisted the internet and the marketing and all those things, and I kind of became the big secret in fitness that people who wanted to further themselves studied me and then represented my stuff as their own, and, you know, that really hurt me for a long time, and even now I still kind of shudder at it because the tribal nature of the internet is what bugs me. It's like, if my tribe's bigger than your tribe, then we'll just attack you if you say anything against our tribal chief.
Yeah.
And that happened recently when I launched my book, Metabolic Damage and the Dangers of Dieting, because one of the industry gurus said metabolic damage didn't exist and his online following is bigger than mine, then they came on in droves to sort of attack me personally. And, you know, it was just ridiculous. But, you know, and some of them said they won't even read the book because so-and-so said it doesn't exist. So why would they read the book for something that doesn't exist? And I'm like, holy cow. And what struck me as a sociologist about it was how chauvinist it ended up being, because metabolic damage is primarily something that affects women.
Yeah.
And the online experts who say it doesn't exist tend to be men.
Be men.
Yeah. So I found that most ironic. And then the ones, of course, locally, there's a few, again, like we were talking about earlier, people that give coaching a bad name. As long as their clients represent them in a contest, that's all they care about. And there's a few local gurus, for lack of a better word. I like the word guru because it's a four-letter word.
Yeah.
And, you know, they put their clients on these ridiculous keto diets and whatnot. So they've also latched on, male or female, they've latched on to this, you know, this notion that metabolic damage doesn't exist, because it's a good way for them to wipe their hands of any responsibility for the after part of the diet that we talked about earlier, when their client who won the contest all of a sudden has gained 60 or 70 pounds. Well, it's their fault because, you know, they're just not disciplined enough. No, there's all kinds of stuff going on inside the body when you subject the body to that kind of stuff, and there's lots of proof of it. So, so that kind of, you know, I got off on a tangent there, but the whole sort of internet following stuff that he who has the most followers must be the smartest. It's just ridiculous, because some of the research that I do, I come across people, and some of the people who have written some of the, like, there's a book, Modern Nutrition and Health and Disease. It's a book I've read twice. It's over 4,000 pages long, and some of the editors of the book I've looked up online to get more info about, and they have a meager online following. But these are people with PhDs, double PhDs at Harvard in nutrition, with no bias. All they do is search for the truth, and some of them have 50 years experience. And, you know, they'll talk about the uselessness of supplements, and they'll talk about, you know, the stuff that I talk about. Yet online, they might have 1,000 followers, whereas I have, you know, 25,000 or whatever, and the guru who insults me has 100,000 followers. So again, it's not, we, you know, under this mistaken notion that the one with the most followers, you know, is the smartest, whereas usually they're just, you know, the most savvy marketers.
Yeah, and they have other people marketing for them too. I mean, that's,
yeah, which is a big thing. It's something that never interested me, because I've always been someone in pursuit of the truth and in search of the truth and things that resonate from what you said earlier, from what my experience tells me is true. All of a sudden, because Guru X says metabolic damage doesn't exist, I'm supposed to pretend that the last 30 years of me witnessing it all of a sudden didn't happen, or I was seeing it wrong.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
that every single lady who wrote me suffering, who has gained 30 pounds, even though she's been dieting on 1,200 calories, she's suddenly a liar.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. But I think that when they trump a single horn, I think it's kind of like, you know, well, here's the latest flag, and they're waving the flag high in the air, and all the cattle run over towards that flag, and then they run back. What do you call that? You called it a sheep.
I called it voguing.
Voguing. No, but there was another reference to, I can't remember what you called it, where everybody kind of follows like sheep. I just loved it. Oh. I'll have to find it.
I call it We the Sheeple.
Yeah.
That one.
The Sheeple. Yeah, it's perfect. But I think because I joined the internet probably, I don't know, it was probably 4 years ago, and one of my taglines is trying to keep the personal in personal training on the internet, because it's a challenge. And I have girls that come on, and then they go off and they go to Nicole Wilkins' website, which I'm pretty sure she doesn't, you know, do her own website, but she's got a paid for thing, and she's got the latest, greatest exercises. Nicole Wilkins is amazing, but she's a genetically gifted woman, amongst other things, and she's, you know, Miss Physique for what, 4 years in a row, 5 years in a row, but you can't fight against that stuff. And so this
you have to take it on, go
for it, because, you know, there's just that you can't. It's challenging. You got to get thick skin. That's what I've learned. Is you got to get
the one thing. The one thing about it, though, Karen, is that I study a lot of different fields, looking for emergent trends and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And what you see is true experts in other arenas have the exact same frustration, and they talk about the exact same things. Like, first person that popped into my head as you were talking was Warren Buffett. And I don't know if you've ever read any of his
stuff.
But so relative to the fitness industry. And one of the things he said earlier on was, everyone wants to follow the herd, but those who follow the herd spend lots of time scraping their shoes.
Wow.
And, you know, yeah, it's just... Yeah. And he talks about, like, in his field of finance and stuff, he talks about stuff that makes no sense to him, like, you know, people that, you know, invest your money for you and all this. Like, he talks about how nonsensical all that is, that using other people's money to speculate and you know, and it, the relevance to a lot of the stuff he was saying. He also goes on about there's a need in every industry to create lots of complications so that you need an expert to unravel it.
Oh, boy.
And that also applies to the fitness industry. Because what you said, I don't know this lady that you just mentioned, and I don't care to know. But no one is an expert because they got a great physique. That's meaningless to me.
Exactly.
And also, there's no such thing as a magic exercise. So you can post 100 of them. It doesn't have, it has no context. You know, it's like I always say in terms of exercises and or supplements, just because we reveal that something is important. So I always use the example of let's say I always say in terms of supplements like that, because that's an easy one to attack. Let's say we discover that vitamin C does all these important things, therefore we should supplement it. Well, if I went to a writing course by Stephen King on how to write novels, mm-hmm. and Stephen King said to me, the vowel A is really important, so you should put it everywhere that you can.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden I start just throwing the vowel A into all my words and sentences, and I end sentences with the vowel A, and I put it in words where it's not there. And, you know, that's the mentality behind supplementation. If we find out it does something, then let's just add it, you know, and we don't understand anything about nutrient absorption and retention rates and excretion rates and how these are all counterbalanced by the body of too much of one and, you know, all this kind of stuff. No one wants to hear that. No one wants to hear, like I said, the people that I've looked up online who have, you know, 40, 50 years of just pure research for the truth, and they have a meager following online because they're not interested in an online mm-hmm. following. They're pure academics, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have a two-part article coming up on my blog. You can look out for it on rebuttal to people who say metabolic damage doesn't
exist. Oh, lovely. I can't wait.
Yeah. And it's got a two-hour lecture in it because they said they can't find an expert or research who you know, would say that metabolic damage exists. Well, I found, in a five-minute search online, I found one. And in a two-hour lecture, she uses the word damaged metabolism about 15 times. So this is someone 25 years experience in endocrinology and internal medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is the fitness industry pays attention to fitness gurus, and I've always said go outside the industry if you want the truth.
Yeah, I always say if it's not popular, that's probably where you should be. If the crowd's following it, I usually don't, because I know that it's not going to be truth. You know, I was always that little bodybuilder on stage when we all had to do our little pose off. Remember the pose offs? Hmm. I would scoot to the other side alone, on the other side, because why would I want to be in the group with nine other women all posing down? I mean, it's a risk, but scoot to the other side and be yourself on the right side of the stage instead of the left, because you're going to have more eyes on you instead of being in with the group, because the group is just elbowing each other out of the way.
And be yourself is the important.
And be yourself, yeah, for sure.
A lot of people don't even know who that is. That's the sad part.
I know, and that's the sad part, because we have divorced ourselves from it, and I see this with women all the time, and my main goal with all my work, and I have a small following. I'm only, I don't know, maybe 130 women. You know, it changes all the time, but we're deep. We're not wide, but we're deep, and those women have been with me for years. But what I find that's common, I don't care what culture, what background, what skin color, how much they weigh, the common denominator in all of us warrior women, as we call ourselves, is coming to a place of self-love and self-acceptance and coming to know ourselves and finding our power. I always say, you know, when my world was falling apart, I found myself in the gym, not because I was building great biceps, but because lifting weights is so primal. You know, you have to try to exert yourself over the weight to lift it, and it connected me back into my power. And we're so taken out of our power in this culture in so many ways, mentally, spiritually, physically, emotionally, that when you do something like weight training, when you put good food in your body and you enjoy that food and you don't deny yourself, that's the most empowering thing you can do. And it's about trying to get that self-love back. And so what I see is women have given away so much of themselves because we're in a society that does that easily. It takes from us, but we also think we have to give that in order to be worthy. And so we're all about trying to take back the power, not power over, but power within. And I always say, lead by example. Don't preach to anybody. Don't tell them what to do, what to read, how to eat. Your best lesson is to live by example. And if you do it quietly and steadfastly, eventually those women and people are going to turn to you and say, wow, what are you doing? You know, this is, you're making changes. And that's the best way to teach, I think, is walk the walk.
Well, it's the best way to teach if someone wants to be taught. So,
well, exactly.
You know,
and those that don't, you got to let them go.
Yeah. It's like the old saying, when the student is ready, the master will appear.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. And, you know, what you described about when things are going bad, it's one of the things that I say over and over again is, you know, the difference between, you know, finding my own foundation and training and stuff was different when I became an expert than what I was ended up being surrounded by, that I wasn't witnessing people being in it for the same reasons I was. And when interviewers ask me what that is, I came to the quote a couple of years ago, I think, when I was doing that book, and it's just what training can be. And training can be, when you put it all together, is the place where you lose yourself and find yourself at the same time, and the place where everything can become nothing, and for a limited time, that nothing can become your everything.
Right.
And that is so reinvigorating to the soul and spirit to have anything like that. For some people, it's gardening. For other people, it's painting. For, you know, whatever that may be, but that outlet. But you start doing it to lose 10 pounds, to lose 20 pounds, to be a certain dress size, you're robbing yourself of that potential. So I think that's what you're outlining there.
That's beautiful. Scott, thank you so much for this. Oh, my gosh, I could talk to you for days, but I know you have to go train the world and change the world, and you have to go do that blog. I can't wait. Listen, tell us all where we can find you. ScottAbleFitness.com. I'm going to put that link on. You're also on Facebook, yes, under Coach Scott Abel.
Coach Scott Abel. I have a fan page. I don't use my personal page. So, yeah, CoachScottAbel.com, and I have snippets there a couple times a day. You know, usually coach them up stuff or fitness-related stuff or just thoughts. So, yeah, they can find me there, and then they can write me at scott@scottable.com if someone wants to write me. Or, you know, just they can message me on Facebook if they like.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so
much. And look for the upcoming course on my site for the Empowered Women Experience 20-week course for people who really want to affect change and they want to have all the tools in the toolbox to do it, not just a limited number of them.
Mm-hmm. And I'll be putting that up on my private pages and on my blog when it comes available as well.
Awesome.
Any last parting words of wisdom, Scott, to all of my listeners?
No, just, you know, no. I mean, I don't want to go off on a tangent. I think we gave them plenty to noodle over.
I think you did. I think it's brilliant. Thank you so much. I've looked forward to this for many moons, and I'm thankful I connected with you again, although you don't remember. It's okay. And I'm sure we'll do more in the future. Thank you so much, Scott.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies, and we'll update you soon, okay? So stay tuned. Take care. Ciao. Let me just turn this baby off.